This is Monocle on Design. I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show...
We feel so happy when we hear people, they're saying what a beautiful thing made in Tripoli, and they share posts on Facebook. They're talking about the project, so it was very beautiful.
We see how more is being made of public space in Tripoli, northern Lebanon. Plus...
For architects within Vancouver, there's a lot of opportunity. As architects, we're able to be more focused on what we really want to produce, and that is that durability of a product and material that is going to be a lasting representative of the Pacific Northwest.
Why a new generation of industrial designers are hanging out their shingles in Vancouver. And a look at the highlights from the final leg of fashion's spring-summer 2019 season with Monocle's very own Jamie Waters. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. First up, public space and why it's becoming increasingly scarce. Developers are buying up chunks of our cities and places in which to stop and while away a few moments on a patch of grass, a flight of steps or judiciously placed bench are becoming less and less common. Lebanon's capital, Beirut, is notorious for its lack of open-to-all spaces. But second city Tripoli in the country's north also lacks safe, clean community spaces. All that on top of a struggling economy and mounting security woes. Now, however, a project to improve both public seating and boost northern Lebanon's furniture manufacturing sector at the same time is coming to fruition. Monocle's Beirut correspondent Lizzie Porter reports.
The project, since we made it in the island, the project was inspired by the seashells and the waves. We can see the wave move of the bench. Plus, because the island is a public place for people, they come from all over the city, this small city.
That's Nadine Aljundi, an architecture graduate from North Lebanon. We're sitting beside the sea at El Mina, the port area beside Tripoli, Lebanon's second largest city. We're perched on a stylish bench that Nadine designed with a team of colleagues. It is a curved semicircle, inspired by the shape of a seashell, and intended for family groups. The seat tapers at the edges for smaller, child-sized bottoms. A 2-hour drive from Beirut, Tripoli and its surrounds have suffered from a poor reputation in recent years. Spillover from the war in neighbouring Syria has spurred violence along sectarian lines, and the economy has faltered. But one scheme is trying to help by getting North Lebanon's furniture manufacturing industry back on its legs and improve public spaces to boot. Earlier this year, the UN Industrial Development Organization, UNIDO, joined with Beirut Design Week on a public call for furniture designs at El Mina. It was part of a wider project funded by the government of Japan and supported by Lebanon's Ministry of Industry. Other elements have included training 450 workers from North Lebanon, and cutting-edge carpentry machines have been brought from Japan and Austria. I'm at the Ministry of Industry building in central Beirut with Naveen Shahani from the UNIDO project to find out more.
The idea was jointly developed with the Beirut Design Week and UNIDO teams. Since Beirut Design Week decided for the first time to move to the north, we did this collaboration with them, and we decided to support the public places because we noticed that there are a lot of places in this area, but no one is taking care of them, and they are very basic, and they need to have some kind of special urban design to be upgraded.
The public call was where Nadine Aljundi and colleagues from the Beirut Arab University entered. Their shell-shaped bench design was one of two ideas that made it from parametric design program to promenade. The other, called Mina Wave, is an attractive, curved design. It has a porch for rainy days, although sadly, it has already fallen victim to graffiti. Back to Tripoli and Nadine.
How do you feel when you see people sitting here and enjoying themselves?
It is considered as the first project executed by us as architects. So we feel so proud and we feel so happy when we hear people there saying what a beautiful thing made in Tripoli, and they share posts on Facebook. They're talking about the project, so it was very beautiful.
Tripoli was once famous for woodwork, particularly elaborate salon designs and bedroom suites. The city's coastal location, port, and proximity to Syria and Turkey opened trade routes. But those very factors also allowed for competition from abroad.
We suffer greatly from problems from foreign furniture imports, Chinese, Turkish, and Egyptian, if you want to be specific. They really affect us, given the cheap prices.
That's Jihad Toros. He learned carpentry from his father, who opened a workshop in Tripoli in 1952. Toros was among the carpenters who crafted the bench design presented by Nadine's team at a nearby technical institute.
How did you feel when you were asked to contribute into actually producing this furniture?
I was really pleased, especially when the project started to come to life on the ground. Of course, it needed to be prepared before, and on the last 2 days we began to put it in place on location. We did the installation, a lot of people came to look and wanted to help in one way or another. Lots of people were happy to see how the work developed from one stage to the next.
But the revival of North Lebanon's economy through the furniture industry is not without hurdles. Even within central Tripoli, electricity runs for only 4 hours a day, meaning carpenters must rely on costly generators. Many people here feel that Lebanon's government neglects the area, with a knock-on effect on small businesses. The Sultan family has worked in Tripoli's carpentry industry since 1968. A black and white photo of the founder hangs on a wall in the workshop now run by his sons, brothers Azam and Mohammed. Azam Sultan explains more.
Tripoli is a second city, but there is poverty, no work, and a lack of interest. The state is not interested in the area.
I ask what could be done to improve the situation, but Azam describes things as catastrophic. All the same, working on new designs, such as the benches, appears a small step forward. Azam's brother Mohammed collaborated with Jihad Toros to produce the public furniture at El Mina. How would he feel about a client asking for a similar design in the future?
Before, no, but now, yes. I can do such a design because I've had experience. And hopefully now I can do any design that is requested of me, any size, in any place. I can provide the required piece.
For Monocle, in Tripoli, I'm Lizzie Porter.
Our sincere thanks to Monocle's Beirut correspondent, Lizzie Porter, there. The spring-summer 2019 women's wear season wraps up tonight with the Louis Vuitton show in Paris. It's been a big season, with the fashion crowd shuttling from New York to London, Milan and Paris. Poor them. There have been a host of eye-catching shows, from Prada's Preppy Meets Retro collection in Milan to Raf Simons' Jaws-themed Bonanza for Calvin Klein in New York. And there have been two big debuts, by Riccardo Tisci for Burberry and Eddie Slimane for Celine. Here to offer us the skinny and a little bit of insight on everything we may have missed is Monocle's fashion editor, Jamie Waters.
New York and London had a new spring in their step this season, which is quite often criticised for being a bit too commercial. They had the return of a few brands that had previously moved to Paris to show. So they had Rodarte and Parenza Shula, which are kind of very critically acclaimed, more on the end of high fashion artistic brands. So they were back and that put a bit of the avant-garde into the schedule. And they also had big celebrations with a huge do for Ralph Lauren's 50th anniversary. And it's sort of things like that can give an energy to a week. You know, you want those events and big shows to anchor it to. And then also, as they've had for the last few seasons, they've Calvin Klein, which is now designed by Raf Simons, again, gives a bit of that high fashion swag to the week. So that's kind of New York in a nutshell. London was also very much rejuvenated this season because Victoria Beckham, to celebrate her 10th anniversary, she showed in London. She's obviously a British designer, but she normally shows in New York. So she was on the schedule, which again, a big name. And then especially it was Burberry. It was the debut of Riccardo Tisci for the UK's premier luxury house. And I know there were editors and talent, whether that's makeup artists or whatever, but the people who came to London just for the Burberry show, some of whom haven't been to the London shows for a few seasons or a few years even. So it really was this kind of marquee event that got people into the city and created a big buzz. So Milan and Paris are always big, but Milan was slightly quieter. They had one big notable absence, which was Gucci. Gucci showed in Paris this season instead as kind of a one-off. Milan was also without Bottega Veneta, which has a new creative director, so they're not showing this season. Of course, they have Prada, they have Ferragamo and some of those really big brands. And there also was a lot of chatter there. There was the sale of Versace, which happened just after Milan. So there was a lot of talk about Milan, but generally it was a bit quieter. And then Paris was big. It's kind of the biggest. It has everything from the huge houses to the smaller designers, you know, up-and-coming designers. And it had the whole scale this season. And it had Gucci, who had moved from Milan. And it had the debut of Eddie Slimane at Celine, which was the most anticipated event of the whole season. So Paris was huge. So Tisci's debut, an interesting house to come into because Burberry is the luxury UK house. There's been interesting stories reported. The Financial Times did something on how it's Burberry's the barometer of Britain, which is an interesting way to look at it because for so many people around the world, their gauge of British fashion and where it's at, that gauge is taken through where Burberry's at because it's the label that they all associate with the UK and that has such a big presence around the world. Riccardo Tisci has big shoes to fill, and obviously Christopher Bailey, the previous creative director, had been there for 17 years, and Burberry was Christopher Bailey's brand, you know, so he'd really shaped its image. Even before Tisci had started, he had kind of made his presence felt. He's a really good marketer, you know, he's kind of master of marketing. He's got proven form at Givenchy, where he sort of really changed their fortunes. So before he'd even started, he had changed the logo, he'd got a new monogram, he'd posted a few specific items like a t-shirt with the new monogram, a really collectible item. He's good at creating hype around the brand. And then came the show, which was a big show. There were 134 looks, so that's a massive, huge number of looks, men's and women's. And it was just really comprehensive, which is a smart thing because I think if you look at it, there was kind of something for everyone. He kind of covered the spectrum. So it was divided into sort of three sections. There was the classic section, which was trenches, men's suits, and the things that you think of as being Burberry. And he sort of played on the house's codes. So there was the Burberry check. It lined trenches, but there was a slight change on the way it had been done. There was a lot of leather. It was playing with the codes, but you know, you could tell it was Burberry. And then there was a very contemporary young section. Tisci was one of the first designers to bring streetwear into the luxury world. So at Givenchy, he did the sort of Rottweiler prints on sweatshirts, and he did the branded tees and all those sort of things that are now kind of part and parcel of luxury fashion. But he was one of the trailblazers. That's kind of very much what he's often associated with. And it's kind of dark and it's sexy and it's street as well. So the middle section at Burberry was very much in that world, and there were hoodies and there were baggy trousers, trainers, and all those sorts of things. So that's kind of what you expect from him. And that will appeal to a younger consumer and the very kind of streetwear focused consumer, of which there are a lot nowadays. And then the final section was evening wear, which was, again, a bit more classic. It was a kind of smart show because it wasn't mind-blowing, perhaps. There were looks for everyone, and I think it will do well commercially. The other big debut was Hedy Slimane's debut for Celine. this was kind of the most anticipated show of the whole season because Eddie Saman is such a provocative figure in fashion. He's so divisive. He's the one who transformed Saint Laurent's fortunes. He made it, I mean, actually first at Dior, then at Saint Laurent. He brought in the really skinny boy and the super slim tailoring. He's known for his kind of leather jackets, and it's sexy and it's young and it's rocker chic and it's all those kind of things. And that's what he'd done at Saint Laurent. And I think a lot of people are wondering, that aesthetic is so at odds with Celine, which Celine under Phoebe Philo is known for being really elegant and polished and sophisticated and older. So there's kind of this tension between the two looks. And I think everyone was just wondering what he would do with his debut there. And what he did was he did Eddie Slimane. He did the aesthetic he's known for. It was rocker chic, sexy, short black dresses, super slim tailoring for men and women. It was almost exclusively black and white. It was shiny, nighttime, sexy, young. So it was very similar to Saint Laurent, and it was kind of what he's known as. So he completely ripped up the codes of the House of Celine, and he didn't pay homage to the house at all. A lot of designers at the helm of big brands have done that. They've done very much their own thing. But I think he's perhaps the most jarring clash of a new designer at a house. You know, I think in a vacuum, if it was just X brand and you didn't know what the brand was, there are some pieces that are really appealing. I think he does have a distinctive look. Some of the blazers for men and women, some of the coats, some of the shoes, there's some pieces that people will buy and that are really covetable. I think where the great tension comes in is that it's not just X brand in a vacuum. It's the new Celine, and Celine was this brand that filled such an important spot in the market for those women who wanted to dress in a sophisticated way that was also interesting and a bit fashiony, but it was polished and refined. It was all those things. And there perhaps weren't that many other brands that did that. And the new Celine is so at odds with that look. It is so young and sexy, and it's the nightclubbers, and it is sexy in a way, but it's so at odds with what Celine was. That's why a lot of people are upset, and that's where some of the sadness comes in, is that it's completely erased that kind of memory. A lot of people are wondering where they're going to go, because the previous Celine consumer, there's like philophiles who were kind of devotees of Phoebe Philo, and as I said, looking for elegant, sophisticated clothes that were kind of more polished. They're now wondering where they will go. And I think there's a few brands that this season presented a really convincing case for clothes that would attract those consumers. Paul Andrew is doing some really interesting things at Salvatore Ferragamo. This is his second collection there. He was focused on shoes. Now he's doing all the women's wear and men's wear. And there were some really elegant looks, some leather things, earthy palette, and some bright colours as well. But it was very elegant and sophisticated. So I think he's presented a strong case. Chloe is also doing some really covetable things at the moment. It's a bit more bohemian and a bit more feminine than Celine under Philo, which was a bit more minimalist. But Chloe also really appealing at the moment. Of course, Hermes. And then there's some American brands. So I think Gabriella Hearst in New York is also very chic and very sophisticated and understated. So I think Phoebe Philo had such a strong following. And now that she's not designing, at least not for the time being, there is a big gap in the market. And I think that those kind of brands, Ferragamo, Chloe, Gabriella Hearst, Hermes, their time to shine.
Many thanks to our always well-presented Jamie Waters for that roundup. One barometer that points to a city's health is its design sector, from residential and commercial architecture to product design, and even those comely typefaces on the signposts that dot its streets. Vancouver is one of Canada's fastest growing cities and a beautiful place to boot, but it's often lost out when it comes to luring design talent. That, however, appears to be slowly changing, with more designers moving to the city and lots of local talent staying put. Monocle's Toronto bureau chief left the phone ringing in Toronto and the emails piling up to compile this report from Vancouver.
Each year, IDS Vancouver, the West Coast iteration of Canada's most prominent interior design expo, brings together the great and the good of Canada's interior design sectors and those from across the Pacific Northwest too. At this year's instalment, the 14th year that IDS Vancouver has been held, there's a sense that not only are Canada's design sectors in the ascendant, but particularly here in Vancouver too, its homegrown design firms are asserting themselves not just in the city, but further afield too.
My name is Jody Phillips, and I am the director of IDS Vancouver. It has evolved at the same rate as the city itself as far as a design city, and that's been really exciting because there's been a lot of growth in the city in general, and there's been more sort of design appreciation. So we've been growing at the same rate as that. It's an exciting time. I'm a product designer. I'm not an event planner. I love design. That is my background, is in product design, and I'm running this from my love of design. The purpose of it is to really engage and give everyone else a platform, the city and the region a platform. And then hopefully, you know, really encourage growth. Like if we could have more people attend each year, more varied audience, not just the trade, but your average Vancouverite or, you know, person from Seattle, Portland, you know, come and have this be where they are inspired and engage in the community. That is the aspiration. That's my goal.
The fulfillment of that goal is getting closer to becoming a reality, Phillips says, as the city itself changes and design practices are increasingly staying put in the city itself. The erosion of various manufacturing centres or the lack of expertise in the production of certain design sectors meant often that designers who cut their teeth in Vancouver would ultimately have to move away to expand their practices and their ambitions.
What industry do we have here? What sort of fabrication and manufacturing plants do we have here that we can motivate and engage? Like, it goes back to that. So materials that weren't readily available and processes that we didn't have at our fingertips even 5 years ago are now things that we're looking at. So the products have changed for sure.
Among the design sectors to be flourishing here are lighting, where Vancouver-based firms like Bocce were established and are still headquartered here. The design and production of technical fabrics is also in the ascendant here, buoyed by Vancouver-born sports and outerwear brands like Lululemon, Reigning Champ and Arc'teryx. Chad Falkenberg is the co-founder of the Vancouver-based Falcon Reynolds Interior Architecture Practice.
I think we're still just at the beginning of actually understanding what it is. I think a lot of it's subconscious. When we design or we start choosing elements to put in a house, if it's furniture or lighting, some of our go-tos are brands that are designed and made in Vancouver. Bocce and Benson, they're amazing brands, really well-established international brands, but they're also, the people who run them are our friends. And we don't necessarily prioritize them just because we're loyal. I think the way that they design the products actually makes sense for how people live. So it's a very natural way to include them. And our clients actually subconsciously come to us and might want to use a Bocce fixture or a Benson sofa. And I think that's a really fun, it's fun for us because it's supporting our friends, but also never compromising on really good design.
That notion of intimacy within Vancouver's design sectors is a strength and isn't something that needs to be compromised as the city's design firms scale up, says Susan Scott of Scott & Scott Architects, that specializes in residential buildings and more recently retail and restaurant spaces too.
For architects within Vancouver, there's a lot of opportunity. We find we get several inquiries a week and are luckily now in the position where we're able to really select clients. As architects, we're able to, as a result of selecting clients, be more focused on what we really want to produce, and that is that durability of a product and material that is going to be a lasting and also representative of the Pacific Northwest. A lot of our clients have actually arrived in British Columbia from actually all over the world, and it's quite fascinating to see the different reasons that they're arriving here. And also their view of the city and the province from an outsider's perspective. Initially, as we started practicing as architects, there wasn't really an acknowledgement or an understanding of the value of architecture. And more within the city, we're finding that people really appreciate it and are looking for venues to learn more about it and really figure out what what their architectural representation means for them and something that would integrate well into the West Coast.
That sense of a growing confidence in design tastes as well as the output here in Vancouver is present in other sectors as well.
I moved up to British Columbia about 8 years ago from San Francisco. I'm an American turned Canadian. When I moved up to the coast of British Columbia, I had really no option in my mind other than to start designing furniture that was inspired and based on the beauty of the coast of British Columbia.
Riley McFerrin is a furniture maker and designer who founded Hinterland Design in 2010. Is there a sense that there's an energy here at the moment?
100%. I go to trade shows around the world every year, and I've been going to the International Contemporary Furniture Fair in New York, ICFF, for 6 years, and every year I just see better and better work showing up there from Vancouver. And a lot of times you're not even aware of what's happening in your own backyard until you see it on the kind of international stage, where you realize that there is just this amazing kind of explosion, I feel, of furniture and lighting and design that's happening in Vancouver. And it's kind of funny because I feel like Vancouver doesn't even really necessarily embrace that or is even aware of it. But when there's international magazines and international trade shows and success for all of these brands and all of these designers and makers, it makes me so proud that it's coming from Vancouver, because it is not a huge design scene. You're not in New York, you're not in Brooklyn, you're in this little outpost in the Northwest that's a big, beautiful city that's growing, and the scale of growth in the city's kind of out of control, but you still have a relatively small group of people designing and making really, really nice things, and it's super, super inspiring to be a part of it.
For Monocle in Vancouver, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Many thanks to Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis there, who's believed to still be at large in the Vancouver area. And it's with regret that that's all the time we have on this week's show. But don't forget, if you need more design-themed inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday or as a podcast thereafter. You could also delve into the pages of Monocle's monthly magazine, one of our many books published by Gestalten, or, if the time's right, one of our weekly newspapers too. Head to monocle.com for more information. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the always patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.